This is the People and Their Work podcast. I am Professor Doug Gardner in the Student Leadership and Success Studies Department at Utah Valley University. In this podcast, you will hear the first-person stories of people journeying through their education, work, and career decision-making.
Kristen Chandler is an author. She shares her experience with personal struggle, including learning disabilities, and how a special needs son blesses her life. Kristen has great advice for women who are questioning whether education is worth the time and sacrifice. This recording took place during the 2021 UVU For the Love of Reading Conference.
When I was a senior in high school, I loved to write. I loved to write journalism articles because people would read them immediately and comment on them, so I wrote for the school newspaper. I worked on the literary magazine, so I was very involved in writing even at that age. I didn't really know what that meant, and I didn't have a concept of what it meant to be a writer because my experience of writers was reading people like Hemingway and Faulkner and being this outrageously famous character who had some sad, tragic end. My concept of a writer was very romanticized and very unattainable in terms of how do I get from A to whatever that is, Z. But I didn't, you know, do one day you suddenly wake up and people are going to your house because it's a museum. I didn't know what that looked like. And so as I started to kind of think about colleges, I just wanted to have a big experience. I wanted to try new things and explore a lot. And I think that is a really good approach to finding who you want to be. To be honest, I was a Sterling Scholar in English, which I don't know what that means, but the thing that was interesting about that for me was that I had to write this essay about what I wanted to be when I grew up. And it shocked me a few years ago when my mom gave me my portfolio for Sterling Scholar, and I realized that I had kind of done what I thought I was going to do. But along the way, I had tried lots of different things. I've had so many crazy jobs. And all of those jobs, all of those things that I tried on, all those hats I put on and shoes that I put on to be different things, actually was what enabled me to be the thing that I guess I thought I wanted to be when I was 18. But I had to go down those so-called detours to get where I wanted to go. This book that I've been talking about here at this conference, that happened because I wrote about a side gig I did. You know, I just did it for fun because I wanted to work with kids. And that had this snowball effect. I thought maybe I wanted to be a social worker right in the middle of my career. And I took classes in social work. I didn't want to be a social worker, but boy, it changed my perspective. Answered telephones, I've scrubbed floors, I've shoveled horse manure. I've delivered packages, I've been a secretary, worked at a law firm, you know, just done all kinds of things that you wouldn't think have to do with being a writer, but really a writer is just a person that takes the material of their life and puts it on paper. So really any job is a good job for a writer. One of the things that I always tell the students that I have that are freshmen at BYU is that you will change your job at least 7 times. That's what the statistics tell you. That's okay. But get a diverse education. Get an education that allows you to move in and out of change. Don't just be a person that can do one thing. I can do this particular tiny job. So that when change comes, you're ready and you're open. You're willing. You know how to adapt. You have a skill set of things. It's like going on a hike. If you're just going to hike for 30 minutes, sure, you maybe only need to take your car keys. But if you're going to take a hike that's going to last your whole life, you're going to want to take things that are versatile. So you need to be versatile. I got married at a time that I considered was very young. I've remarried since then, but the wonderful person who proposed to me the first time, he proposed to me when I was getting ready to take a final. And I told him that I would answer him after I had taken my final. I was really upset. But, you know, I felt too young, but he was persistent. He proposed 3 times, so I said yes. I got married when I was at the end of my junior year of college, and I was super happy, but I was conscious of the fact that I didn't really know what it meant to, you know, take on those responsibilities, but it was okay. You know, you just adapt. I had my first child 3 years later when I was in graduate school. But when I was undergrad, I didn't know if I wanted to teach high school. I didn't know if I wanted to go try to get a job at a corporation. When you're an English major, you kind of don't know what you're going to do sometimes. And I had some good mentors that told me they didn't think I'd stick around if I was a high school teacher for one reason or another. I had a funny old guy that wore Birkenstocks and wool socks that just told me, it's not your thing, Chris. And I just thought, well, okay. I mean, I'm not sure you're right. We kind of talked about it for a while. And so I decided to pursue getting an MFA, which would allow me to teach in college. And I'm really glad that I did that. The person that I married was going to medical school. And some of my friends said, well, why do you need to do that? You know, you're going to be married. You're going to be set. You're going to have all the money in the world. I just said, because I want to. You know, like I want my own life. And so I got an MFA. I didn't get in the first year that I applied, but I reapplied the second year while I was taking the MA courses. They only let two people in a year into that MFA program, so it was very, very hard to get in. And I got in the second year and I graduated with high honors. So I just, persistence is the name of my, is my life, you know, like if at first you don't succeed, you must be me, you know, so that's kind of what I did. And I loved getting my MFA, but I really thought I was going to write big, serious, dark adult books. And it turned out that wasn't my thing. So my thing is writing probably for a younger audience, but I didn't have that figured out at that point. I wrote two books and they kind of got looked at by houses, but nobody ever really gave me a contract, and I got really frustrated, and I just decided to work full-time and start having my kids. I had my first daughter after I had taught a year at UVU, and I was finishing my thesis for my master's, and it was kind of fun because at my graduation ceremony for my MFA, Chase Peterson, who was kind of a famous guy back then, he was speaking at the vocation, and he said, the convocation, he said, he was being very serious, and all of a sudden, my little daughter, who was a year old, had this really loud squawk, and everybody kind of laughed. I was down with all the other people graduating, but I knew it was my daughter. Like, a big, you know, like a whole, I don't know, thousands of people, and my daughter making this terrible sound, and he said, I bet that little person is really proud of her mom. And I thought, you know what? She will be someday. So that was kind of a fun memory. And then I had my kids. I moved to Oregon and I kept teaching there. And I got too busy to write. And I still wanted to write, but I was frustrated. And so I just taught for a while and then decided I miss Utah. I moved back to Utah, started teaching a little bit, not full time, but teaching a class a semester or two at BYU. And had my last son, and then about, I guess, 3 years after I moved back, I got divorced. And that was really sad and hard for our family. The good part was we all stayed friends, and we all stayed close, and we kind of worked through it all together. And I think there was a lot of time that our kids didn't even know we were divorced because we did so many things together. Over time, I met someone and got remarried, and now we have 8 kids together, and they're all best buddies, and that's been a really neat thing. But in the middle of that, I started writing again, and I wrote another book that didn't sell, and then I wrote another one, and that one got looked at by an agent, but she didn't pick it up, by an editor, but she didn't pick it up right away. It actually took 2 years, and me thinking I was going to quit writing. The day that I thought I was going to quit writing, I got an agent that was interested in my work, and then the next 2 days later, somebody made me an offer, and the house that I had originally given it to made an offer back, and I ended up selling my book. Right when I thought I was going to quit, things all kind of crashed together, and I felt really blessed, but also sort of terrified by how it all came together. I've published 3 books now and continue to teach at BYU, and just, I love what I do. I love the students. I love writing, even though some days I hate writing and some days I hate grading papers. But I always love the students, and I always love the opportunity to go talk with people about books, because they, even if people don't write books, they all have stories, and I love hearing other people's stories. That's the biggest treat for me. When I was in third grade, my mom told me that they had that one of the tests that I had taken at school had shown that I had dyslexia, and that wasn't a word that I knew, but what it amounted to was that I got to go to a special class where they had me put a lot of puzzles together, and then they told my mom that they wanted me to learn how to crawl again because they thought that would rewire my brain. So we did all kinds of crazy things, but it got me out of class, so I thought that was pretty fun. I didn't feel too bad about it. I didn't feel ashamed or embarrassed because it just seemed fun. But the long and the short of it was is that I had trouble reading quickly, and I was a terrible speller, and I was really bad at math. Later in my life, the way that showed up was that I had a really hard time learning another language in terms of writing it and remembering details. And I may have had a little bit of ADHD, but that wasn't as big a deal as the fact that I just had a really hard time with. It slowed down my reading, and it was hard for me to spell. And back in the old days when the dinosaurs roamed the earth and everybody didn't have computers that helped them with their spelling, that was a big deal. It was kind of strange that I would want to grow up and be an English teacher, but my dad, you know, sat me down one night and he said, you know, if you want to write stories, you got to learn to spell. And I thought, well, that's not the same thing, but I understood what he was saying. But I think that it would have been easy for me to get discouraged because I wasn't quote unquote good at reading. I wasn't quote unquote good at writing because of the technical things. In a way, it was kind of empowering for me because when I read a book, I had to love that book. I had to work at the words. And when I finished, I remembered the words. The words belonged to me because I had worked for them. And so when the teacher would ask, well, what happened in that story? Maybe someone who was sitting next to me who'd read it really quickly and could spell all the words, they didn't have the same feeling about the book. And that gave me something that was kind of a secret weapon. As I got older, I found out it really was a secret weapon because I'd be sitting in an English class and my teacher would ask a question and everybody would say, well, I don't know. And I'd know. I'd know the answer. Even though it took me longer to do my homework, I'd thought about it. As I progressed with my experience as a teacher and as a writer, I met lots of kids that had learning disabilities as a teacher. And they would come to me and they'd say, well, I can't do this because I have a learning disability or because I have dyslexia. And while I tried to never assume that my dyslexia was like their dyslexia, I wanted them to know that they could. I didn't know how far they could go, but I knew they could go farther. I knew they could get better. And that sometimes is all you need to know, that you don't have to stay where you are. You can get better. That's been an important and empowering part of my journey. And I still wish that I was better at math and was a better speller and stuff, but you know, computers have been invented that fix that, so it's fine. And that's another thing. I tell my students straight up, use technology to help you. That's why it's invented. Use Grammarly, use spell check, use all the things that, I mean, if you were taking an advanced math class, you'd use a calculator and not feel bad about it. So use the technology that's being created for you to make you better at what you do well. If you're good at telling stories, but you're not good with grammar, find some technology to help you. That's great. That's just you adapting. Just to kind of give you an illustration of what being a writer is like, I had a terrific young woman in my neighborhood who, for a school project, needed to go to work with someone she wanted to be like. So she asked me if she could come to work with me one day and see what I did as a writer. And I said, but all I do is write, so you know that I'm just gonna sit and write while you're sitting there, right? And she's like, oh yeah, that's fine. So she came over to my house and we sat down, you know, it was 8:30 in the morning, the sun coming through the window. And I said, okay, well, I'm gonna go to work now. And I just started working. And about 10 minutes later, she's like, you just sit here all day? And I said, yeah. If it's a good day, I just sit here all day. And she was horrified. I said, no, I mean, you're just sitting here. I am in my story. And then she kind of got what the experience was like for me. When I was writing my first book that got published, Wolves, the editor who wanted to see the story, she saw the first chapter and then she wanted the whole book. And I only had 80 pages written. And so I went home and told my kids that summer was canceled and that I had to finish this book by August because that's when she wanted it. And my kids were really nice about it. They put up with it. But I had to sit down and pump out a book. And that was terrifying. Plus, I had an agent who was interested, an editor who was interested. So I had to do a good job. But I literally got calluses. I mean, I just had to sit down and push myself through. But The cool part about it was that my kids could leave. Like one morning I was working on the scene where it was a really wintry scene, and my kids all had to go do something that day. And when they came home, they rang the doorbell and I ran to the door to open it. And I looked out and I realized it wasn't winter. I had been winter all day and outside it was summer. And I realized what a joy that was for me to be in my story so deeply that was more real to me than the world outside. I mean, that's pretty awesome. So when I've had a good day, I don't know what time it is. I don't necessarily change out of my pajamas. I just get lost in the story, and there you can't put a price on that. That's pretty awesome. But I wouldn't say that it's necessarily always glamorous. I've had some pretty glamorous moments, but those are short-lived. The real joy of being a writer, if you want to be a writer, don't become a writer to become famous. Don't become any job to become famous, because being famous is messy. Be what you want to be because you're going to do it every day, because you want to play the piano, because you want to paint, because you like doing math, because you like teaching. Your job is what you do every day. It's not the recognition that you get for it. I have an opportunity to work with some terrific people in my job as a college instructor, but I remember one day I was talking to this really fun, bubbly young woman, and she said, you know, this is just so hard doing school, and I just sometimes I think it would just be easier if I just, you know, quit and just got married and just didn't have to worry about this anymore. Then everything would be taken care of. I could just have kids. And I said, you know, I know that it might seem like that, but if you look around at the women who are married, and if you look around at the whole, you know, how people that are all different stages of your life, that's kind of like saying, it's really hard to walk. I think I'll just cut my legs off, because it is not easier without an education. If you're going to raise children, you need to be smart enough to raise them. If you want to feel like you're part of the world, you need to study the world. And whether or not you ever get paid for it, it really is irrelevant. You've been given an intelligence. You've been given health. If you waste that, you have missed an opportunity. So I don't necessarily know what people should do for a living, male or female, but don't give up an education when you can go after something that will last you, that will create a foundation of learning for your whole life. And the fact is, whether you have a dozen kids or you never have kids, most women spend some time in the workforce. And it is much nicer to be in the workforce doing something you like and you're good at than doing something that anyone can do that you get no respect for. So I would strongly recommend that people develop a skill set. And that's something I tell people that are going into writing too. I say everybody needs to have a really good plan B. Everybody needs to have a good plan B, because plan A may not be what you want and it may change. So swing for the fences, do the thing you want to do that you love doing, that you love studying, but always have a skill set that if you need to pick up and get a job tomorrow, that you can get a job that's going to pay you a living wage and that you can feel okay about going to every day and doing. And I would tell that to any person that has the opportunity to be in school, that it doesn't get easier to go back to school. I went back to school and it was hard. So if you're in school now, it's kind of like if you are on a school athletic team and you get in really good shape. So like, for example, you're on the cross country team and you're running miles every day, and then you just say, well, it's kind of hard. I think I'll just take a break for a couple of weeks. But everybody else keeps training. And you're playing Nintendo or whatever, and then you go back. You've lost some of that, and you have to get it back, and everybody else has been going. So I tell students, it's great if you're coming back to school. That's awesome. You can do it. But if you're in school right now, get it done. Get it done. Go to school and at least get the amount of education that you need to make a good start in your life, and know that it's a little bit harder to come back. You can do it, but you have to kind of remember that that's a little bit tougher. You lose, being a student's hard, and you get kind of muscles for it. You know, you learn how to stay up and push through and all those things. And when you take a break from it, sometimes, you know, students get a little shocked by that. When I got divorced, I was still teaching at BYU, kept doing that. And then I started writing. And I didn't get published until like it was about 4 years later, right? Then I decided that because it was very difficult to be a mom and travel and write, I was writing another book, you know, I was doing too many things, that I would take some time off while my books were selling really well and I had the opportunity, I would just focus on that for a little while. So I did that, was lucky enough that I could do that. I met my husband and I got remarried. We had 8 kids and we had expenses. And so we decided that it would be good for me to go back to work. But about a year into being married, then I decided I didn't really know if I wanted to go back to teach or if I wanted to go back into something else. And so I took a year of social work classes at BYU. And I did internships and I, you know, kind of tried it out. And I loved my classes. And I kind of thought I was going to do it, but I ended up not doing it. Once I really started talking to other social workers, I realized I wasn't cut out for it. And I thought, why did I feel like I should do that? I had such a strong feeling that I should really take those classes, and it felt so great to learn all of that. Why did this turn out wrong? And what I realized in hindsight was I just needed to know those things. I didn't need to be a social worker. I just needed to study social work. And so I am so glad that I was able to take those classes and to learn those experiences. It was life-changing for me. And I've had a lot of experiences like that. At the time, it seems like, well, this is going to work out, and it's going to work out just like this. But what it works out is I just needed to learn something. And, you know, nobody paid me for it. Nobody put a gold star on my forehead. I just needed to have that life experience. When my son was born, it was really scary because we didn't know anything about what was happening. He had such a rare condition that he was born with corneal atresia, which is a very, very rare condition. But luckily, his dad was a doctor, and he diagnosed him basically within seconds of him being born and intubated him, and everybody freaked out and whatever. But anyway, we got him figured out quick enough that he didn't have severe other problems because he was misdiagnosed. But for a year, we had to be back and forth to Primary Children's Hospital, and it felt like the world was going to end every day. I had to learn during that year. I knew that he was going to be our last child. It was going to be my last chance to have a baby. And I didn't want to miss that moment because I was worried. But if I could go back now and kind of talk myself through that, that's the one thing I would really tell myself. Don't be so scared. Just enjoy it. Just be there. Laugh and have fun and see the funny things that happen every day. Things will work out, you know? And so we got through that first year and a half, and we got things kind of figured out so he could breathe right and everything. And then we kind of saw some milestones that were not where they needed to be, and we thought it was because of what had happened. But, you know, after a while I read some books and I kind of self-diagnosed, and then we got him in to be diagnosed with these issues. There was a story kind of going around when I was kind of figuring out some of these things. It was put in some religious magazine where it talked about being on a trip where you think you're going to go to Paris. And you're on the plane, and, you know, you got your outfit picked out, and you're thinking about eating croissants. And all of a sudden, you get off the plane, and you're in Holland. And you're like, this is where I wanted to go. I wanted to go to Paris. I got my stuff picked out. And you're in Holland, and you're never getting on the plane to Paris. You're going to be in Holland. And so you get out of the plane, and you can either, you know, look at the things that you are not going to have, or you can go out and look at the tulips and you can be happy in Holland. And that's been what we've done, is we've been happy in Holland. And it's been I don't know anybody that really, I mean, there are some really much harder situations than my own, but everybody that has a child with special needs knows that there is an opportunity for growth that is exceptional, that you are going to learn things you would never have learned any other way. You are going to, your heart's going to grow, your family's heart is going to grow, and you know, you just have to look at the tulips because that's where you are. But for me, it's been great. I've worked in the school a lot with my son, Luke, and that was really eye-opening and great because I got to meet other kids that were dealing with their challenges and other moms, and community is really great when you're dealing with something you don't understand. The thing that I found in Luke's classroom was kids were never mean. They were just, you know, like, it's not like they didn't think of being mean. They did, you know, like they had a choice to be mean, but, you know, there were some perks to being in a small group like that. And I never left there without thinking that I was happier than when I walked in. So I think that there's just a lot of opportunity. And I feel like the schools that have integrated classrooms, they're nicer schools. They kids are kinder. And there's less an emphasis on getting and having and more about just sharing. I had an opportunity when my third son was 16 to go work down in an orphanage down in Peru. And we did a lot of stuff while we were down there, but we were part of this group. And, you know, I sometimes get a little worried about people saying that, you know, we came in and we gave all this stuff to these kids and aren't we great? You know, because I didn't feel like that. This is what these kids gave to me. We show up at this orphanage and the people that I'm with, they're so awesome. They've picked out presents for each kid by name, right? Like they have absolutely chosen perfect little things to give to each child. And we get there and the orphanage has like 7 more kids than had been on the list. And so we didn't have presents for them. And everybody was freaking out because, you know, they had a present for each child. And in this orphanage, each child had one set of clothes they wore and one set of clothes they didn't wear. And that was it. You know, they were like, well, I picked him out this ball and everything. And so everybody was all worried about it. And they were like, well, we'll just figure it out. The kids that got here late, we'll just give them some other little thing. And so we called each kid up and gave them their stuff. And then we kind of told them that we were going to give these other small gifts. Those kids were so awesome. They took their stuff and they put it all on a table and they shared without missing a beat. They didn't care. They just wanted everybody to have something. And it just made me realize how dumb I was. You know, like I was so worried about everybody having a thing and they were just worried about everybody being happy. And I think that's something you see all the time in communities where people need to share. They know how. So kids with special needs, they know how to share because that's how they get by. Something that I've been thinking a lot about and I feel strongly about is that we're really hard on ourselves in this culture. We have parents and friends telling us what we should do, and we have social media telling us what we should be. You know, we should be on this trip, or we should have this thing, or be skinny like this person, or whatever. I really feel like we have to figure out where we can go, where we can just be. Maybe that's being with your dog. Maybe it's going for a walk. But I want every person in the world to have a way to grow a private, healthy space inside themselves where they know they're okay. To find that thing that they like to do that makes them feel okay. And that process of finding that thing is what's going to get you through. I just, you know, everybody says, well, you know, you should love yourself or whatever. That's really hard to do when you're feeling bad about yourself. But if you have a go-to place or a go-to thing that you like to do, like you like to play tennis or draw or read or, you know, just the thing that you do that you don't have to think about whether it's good or not, keep that. Don't lose that. Make time for that because that will remind you of your spark, the thing that makes you special, that the world doesn't get to define for you.
I am Doug Gardner, and this has been the People and Their Work podcast. Music by Christopher Weiss. Images are from the UVU Roots of Knowledge stained glass exhibit by Holdman Studios.